I don't have to tell you things are bad. Everybody knows things are bad. It's a depression. Everybody's out of work or scared of losing their job. The dollar buys a nickel's worth. Banks are going bust. Shopkeepers keep a gun under the counter. Punks are running wild in the street, and there's nobody anywhere who seems to know what to do, and there's no end to it. We know the air is unfit to breathe and our food is unfit to eat. We sit watching our TVs while some local newscaster tells us that today we had 15 homicides and 63 violent crimes, as if that's the way it's supposed to be. We know things are bad, worse than bad. They're crazy. It's like everything everywhere is going crazy, so we don't go out anymore. We sit in the house, and slowly the world we're living in is getting smaller, and all we say is, please, at least leave us alone in our living rooms. Let me have my toaster and my TV and my steel-belted radios, and I won't say anything. Just leave us alone. Well, I'm not going to leave you alone. I want you to get mad.
I'm Janitara Begum, and I work in Operation Unite, and you're tuned to 90.7 FM WGXC. ACRA.
Hello, WGXC listeners. This is Rachel Shulman. Campa Huston is hosting a monthly community dinner on Tuesday, February 6th at 5:30 in our Solaris Building, 360 Warren Street. Come experience community, meet new people, and old friends over a freshly prepared meal made by a local volunteer. Everyone is invited. No one will be turned away. We will be glad to see you there. Please bring a friend.
WGXC underwriting support is provided in part by Upstate Films, featuring first-run and repertory films at movie theaters located in Rhinebeck and Saugerties, as well as live music, filmmaker conversations, staged readings, community events, variety shows, magic, comedy, and more. The Hudson Valley Picture Show traveling series brings cinema to locations around the region. The latest schedules, as well as upcoming pop-up events at the Community Theater in Catskill, can be found at upstatefilms.org.
Wave Farms WGXC is made possible in part by the generous support of Meredith Cooey in Catskill, New York. WGXC monthly supporters care deeply about Creative Community Radio. Their generosity and investment keep this unique station viable. You too can become a monthly supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and establishing a donation at the amount of your choosing. We hope you will do so. Thank you so much for your support.
There is nothing wrong with your television set. Do not attempt to adjust the picture. We are controlling transmission. If we wish to make it louder, we will bring up the volume. If we wish to make it softer, we will tune it to a whisper. We will control the horizontal. We will control the vertical. We can roll the image, make it flutter. We can change the focus to a soft blur or sharpen it to crystal clarity. For the next hour, sit quietly and we will control all that you see and hear. We repeat, there is nothing wrong with your television set. You are about to participate in a great adventure. You are about to experience the awe and mystery which reaches from the inner mind to the outer limits.
Specific Objects, Talks on Art in the Catskills, and I'm your host, Miriam Atkin. Today I'm delighted to have here with me in the studio the Lanesville-based interdisciplinary artist, Amanda Turner Pohan, known as Pohan. So I'm going to start by reading a short bio to give you a sense of who she is and what she does. Pohan is an interdisciplinary artist based in the Catskills. She recently completed a public sculpture in collaboration with the United States Geological Survey for the Rochester Institute College of Art and Design campus, supported by a NISCA Media Arts Assistance Fund grant and Wave Farm Radio. Her most recent video work, Alexa Echoes, screened at the 36th edition of Images Festival in Toronto. Pohan, it's great to be talking to you today.
You too, Miriam.
So, I see your work as a doorway into other worlds, and I think it makes sense to start off right away by opening that door. So I'm going to play the audio stream from your public sculpture titled Between Scylla and Charybdis, which is currently installed at the RIT campus. So, Pohan, can you say a bit about what we've just heard?
You just heard the Genesee River sing. There are three sort of distinct vocal tracks of the same vocalist singing. And then there's this background tone that you hear. And each of those tracks correspond to a hydrological data point that is being recorded by a sensor unit installed by the United States Geological Survey, otherwise known as USGS, which is how I'll refer to it, and specifically at Ford Street Bridge, which is one of the many stations that they have along the Genesee. The Genesee is, all the water bodies or many, many of the water bodies in this country are monitored by USGS. Some of them are monitored for... mostly for things like water level and temperature. This one in particular is also monitored for pollutants. There's a lot of historic and current pollution that has been dumped into the Great Lakes that then get filtered into the tributaries, Genesee River being one of them. So each of these data points, I'm essentially, they're being reported by USGS to their website. And I had the help of the wonderful Jay Tobin to help me write this software sound translation program that takes those data points and translates them into a sound library that was pre-recorded with the also incredible Charlie Looker, who's a musician and composer out of Queens. And so we created this library of sounds vocalized by Daisy Press from the city. And basically, any time a data point comes in or the fluctuations in the water quality change, it grabs a different sound file. And so there's about 5,000 different permutations of compositions that can arise depending on the quality and composition of the river at any point in time. And that background tone is relative to the water level. So it's not necessarily when the water level is up, it's really high. It's just sort of based along something called the harmonic scale, which just kind of changes very incrementally. But we just felt like it needed, the vocals needed a kind of grounding in a tonality. And yeah, it creates another kind of atmosphere within a world, as you said, of this sounding.
So, I mean, considering that you've worked hard on this project for a long time and have been interacting with these sounds for a long time in their relationship to the river, when you listen to it, do you have a sense of like, oh, I mean, based on this tone that I'm hearing, I know that the river is doing this thing at this moment. Like, do you have that sort of immediate connection with the sound?
At this point, yeah. But it, of course, it's very incremental. So that is sort of the idea, or one of the ideas, as to are there different ways of us being attendant to the weather, and the sort of also correlation between the weather of the body and the weather of the external weather of the environment. And so, yeah, so luckily the piece is up for at least 2 years with a possible extension. But the nice thing about having something that's so durational is that, you know, a student on campus, or really because it's online, anybody can tune in at different times of the year. You can then attune yourself to whether it's, you know, October and it's really, it's been a really dry October. You would have a sense of what that sound is like versus, you know, I don't know, the right now it's been pretty wet, or it's going to be getting more wet, a wet spring. So yeah, it's like, what are the different ways that we can, you know, because data, I'm grabbing data points, right? And so much of the way that we humans interact with our bodies, our environment, politics, is through data points, which are abstractions of humanity or abstractions of non-human life. And so so what does that even mean? Like, to say that, you know, dissolved oxygen is 3.29. But putting it in a different kind of context that is you know, humanized and sensorial, I'm hoping to connect to some level of embodiment that can imagine or relate ourselves to sort of non-human events or entities in a different way.
Yeah, that's interesting, because in a sense you're taking something that is very human and sensorial and immediate, which is like the feeling of being next to a river, and then abstracting it via those data points, and then channeling those data points into an object or an experience that is, again, human and sensory and immediate. So, yeah, and it sounds like the experience of the piece is going to be very different if you're actually there on the campus. And there is a visual element of the piece, right? A sort of sculptural body that it lives in. Can you describe what that is?
Sure, yeah. So the piece, and if anyone listens to this and finds, we could announce the name of the website where you can hear the live stream, and actually you can hear it through Wave Farm Radio as well, because They generously allowed some space on there, in their outer space, to broadcast the audio. But it's only active during daylight hours because the whole piece is solar powered. Mm. And it sort of follows. So what you encounter on campus are, it's just a very utilitarian looking object. It looks like potentially the other kind of solar powered lights or mechanisms that they might have on campus, but sort of enlarged and at sort of human or human scale. Like some of the lighting fixtures on the campus are, you know, the solar panels are way up high. So this is sort of scaled down and out of context because it's in the middle of a kind of where you would encounter sculpture, like, you know,
right,
traditional public art sculpture. But it's just an aluminum box. It has computer, like electronic components in it, a computer, and the lithium ion battery that powers the solar panels. And part of the other reason for it being solar powered kind of comes from this feminist server manifesto gathering that happened in Brussels in, I don't know, some 10 years ago, that sort of imagines, you know, what they imagine as a feminist server is one that isn't always available, you know, if it doesn't perform, that's your problem. You know, it's not always already ready for you to perform, to participate, to behave. We have these expectations that the internet is always ever available and it's never not going to be there. But you know, I think 10% of world's energy is spent on the internet and the use of servers to kind of drive and support the storage of data. So this is just like an independently functioning thing. Mm. And so, yeah, so you can't hear it at night. She goes to sleep. Mm. She rests. And if it is excessively snowy and the solar panels covered, it will be off for a few days.
Right.
And then if you don't hear the voices at all, that is because there's precipitation, which means that it's raining or it's hailing or whatever precipitant might be. Mm. So the voice is cut out, and then you're sort of, it's another way of then being reattentive to the sounds that may already exist. If you're listening to this in Rochester and you're like, oh, let me see what this sounds like, and you can't hear it, you might then become attuned to, oh, because I actually hear the rain outside. Mm. Yeah. You don't hear the vocalization. So yeah, there's all these sort of dependencies or interdependencies on how it functions.
Yeah. Well, maybe I can see it in person someday. I would really like to.
Cool.
So this piece brings in different types of data and information and technology, different artistic mediums, and it's a deeply interdisciplinary piece. And I'm just wondering, did you start off making this kind of work, or was there some medium that originally motivated your interest in art making that sort of branched out into this very interdisciplinary practice?
Many factors, I think. I mean, in, you know, undergrad, I was like a figurative painter of oils. So I think, I mean, baseline, I mean, even just like art from, I don't know, high school. I mean, the body was always the center of any kind of investigation or inquiry. And I think it was actually an amazing artist and teacher, Yuta Kother, in undergrad, was like, these paintings look like stills from a movie. There was like movement. Why don't you pick up a camera and like, why don't you take a video class? Mm. Which maybe was also like, maybe you should stop painting. But anyway, so I started to get into video, and then there's something about using time-based media that just made more sense to me. It's also something that was familiar as a child, making just movies as a child with friends, was something that we would do. And I think just, you know, then through working in different kind of school settings, and using the technology that was around, it was just like, let me play with these things. But I think, you know, I think it's a combination of what was around me to use, and also just, kind of deep personal loss. I lost my mother at 23 to suicide. So I think that, you know, what ended up, I mean, that was basically everything that I make is about my mother. And now I am a mother, soon of two. And so that's adding another layer, but there's something that's just very basic when someone close to you is gone. You are left with all their stuff. You're left with the data. You're left with like the evidence, the material of their lived life, which you try to square with the sort of memory in your body, in your blood, in your bones, in your dreams, in your nightmares, which is, you know, you can't grasp. So I think at a very basic level, there was that kind of disconnect of the material and immaterial experience. It feels interdisciplinary. You can't point to one thing. So I had to point to many things and use many things at hand in order to still get to something that you still cannot grasp. There's always a kind of longing that belies, I think, anything that I make, that I'm trying to get close to a body or close to a human or close to an experience, but the use of technology is a way to always keep it at a distance. I mean, it's funny. I really like, don't like the internet. I don't like websites. I don't like how they look. I don't like using it, but I use them in my work, because of the way it makes me feel, which is alienated, and distanced.
Yeah. I mean, that really comes through. When I experience your work, it is the experience of, I don't know, the attempt to account for or represent a kind of sensory or emotional immediacy, but also the feeling of the failure of that representation, and also this very expansive exploration of all of the different media available in order to potentially make that connection, make that immediate sort of electric charge between what is felt and how it is said. And I feel like the failure is felt over and over. And that experience of desire for expression and failure is very present in the work. And I think the interdisciplinarity of it is also representative of this kind of, well, it's just very investigative. It just feels like you are, or the artist is, or the speaker or the character is pulling in all the materials available that might provide the answer to a question.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very essayistic in that sense. And I think maybe this would be a good moment to turn to another piece of yours, which is a film you completed in 2021 called Alexa Echoes, and it screened at the Experimental Media and Performing Arts Center at RPI, and that was in 2021, correct?
Yeah, so in 2020, it was a residency where I shot the film there, and that was through a partnership with the Bard CCS program.
Okay,
and then I edited it through that winter, and it was quote released through MPAC in early 2021.
And maybe before I play the clip, can you explain a bit about what the film is and what was the composition process?
What the film is definitely through the process of, you know, considering festival submission is in this like nowhere zone of uncategory. It's just like an awkward amount of, it's 30 minutes, which is an awkward amount of time. It's not experimental per se. It's not narrative per se. But the piece, so the piece started, you know, I've been sort of curious about Amazon's Alexa since she sort of appeared on the market, partially because her voice kind of reminded me of my mother's voice, which was always, you know, she really articulated and enunciated very, very well. She really worked out her sort of New Jersey working class whatever twang that was to not sound that way, to erase the sort of class from her vocality in that sort of in an aspirational way, which worked for her. But yeah, there's just this very gentleness to her voice, which indicates that there's nothing wrong. Everything is, you know, she's like, maybe she sounds, and this is a big question of the work. I think most people, surveys have been done, she sounds, quote, white. And so that also brings up a whole question of the racialization of voice and the performance of voice. And we also just automatically call her she. So the gendering of voice and what is it that voices get gendered and that voices get racialized. Mm-hmm. And just also the dynamic of the submissive dynamic, dynamic of the vocal assistant. And so the piece basically began with like looking into why Alexa, why this name, where does her name come from? Well, it comes from the Library of Alexandria. So I was brought to ancient Greece. The mechanism, the speaker that Alexa speaks through is called Echo, mm-hmm. which is also a character from ancient myth. So I immediately was sort of, you know, I use a lot of, and the title of the piece we were talking about before, Between Scylla and Charybdis, is Homeric. It comes from the Odyssey. Scylla and Charybdis were two mythic sea monsters, female sea monsters that, you know, threaten the lives of men. Mm-hmm. So most women, you know, mythical women represented in the Greek tradition are threats to men.
Right.
So just this investigation into why and how female vocality has been so threatening, needs to be regulated in civic space. And then I just sort of went down a rabbit hole that one of the manifestations of that is this film.
And just because we're audio only as a radio show, yeah, just a little bit about what it looks like, and maybe just like I'm interested in what the composition process was. Was it collaborative, or what came first? Did the text come first? Did you build the text off of the actors? Things like that.
Yeah, thank you for reminding me the essence of your question, the composition. Yes. It started in writing, and that's usually where my practice begins. It first begins with reading.
Yeah.
And then I translate whatever I've been reading into some writing, and then automatically a sort of, you know, I don't know, vision forms from that. But so I wrote this script, and the script is actually, it's probably, I think it's about 80%, let's say, citations that I sort of wove together into a narrative. I had a teacher, Lauren Berlant, I was once kind of nervous about being over citational. And she had said to me, to cite someone is to bring them along with you. So it felt like I was collecting these writers with me.
Yeah.
Wendy Chun and Carson and Jacqueline Rose and all these, bringing these people along, to sort of like nod to where I was coming from in terms of the lineage of sort of like feminist or queer or media studies theory. And so I built the text from there, and some of it got modified with the actor that I used, who is Katie Pink. So basically what you see, that the whole film was shot at MPAC. It uses two of their three performance spaces. It sort of uses the behind the scenes spaces to sort of, there becomes this dynamic between what the visible and invisible. You know, so much of software and its power is in its invisibility. You don't see the back end. And so I was trying to kind of, visually the film is sort of like, there's a mix of footage that is straight from the camera that's shot on one of the stages. And then woven into that becomes the exposure of the editing software that I used to make the film itself, which really doesn't expose anything because, again, you're not meant to see how it functions, as software is very sort of obscuring in that way. And then the behind the scenes, moving through all the backspaces that you don't see as an audience member, you know, in the dressing rooms and at rehearsal spaces, et cetera, at MPAC. So, yeah, and it's, and Katie is the only actor, which was also a product of COVID. So this, everything had to change to accommodate 10 people on set at any one time, and therefore one cast member. And Katie plays sort of three different manifestations of the voice. And one of them is this sort of like TED Talk character and the performativity of that and the sort of tropes of that. And then, I won't reveal more because I'll give something for people to want to see how she transforms.
Yeah. Well, let's play, I will play a clip from the beginning of the film in which I see Katie to be assuming that TED Talk kind of role. Correct me if you feel differently about it. Yeah, but this is right from the beginning.
These tales inevitably depict a female gifted in music, oration, sonification, and a male competitor, suitor, sorcerer, who overpowers the female and presses her into submission. They all end with the destruction of the female and her transformation into a sonorous phenomenon, a singing bird, an echo, software. These tales are more than just an elucidation of pleasant or unpleasant sounds. They aspire to be musical themselves, wherein the sonority of women is curtailed, and sonorous women are transformed into enigmatic aural phenomena or sonic objects that need to be interpreted by men. That way they can kill them and say, it's not murder, it's a metaphor. First, there was a bird.
If you're just tuning in, this is Specific Objects, Talks on Art in the Catskills. I'm your host, Miriam Atkin, and here in the studio with me is Lanesville-based interdisciplinary artist Amanda Turner Pohan, known as Pohan. Yeah, so just to describe, we have a somewhat androgynous-looking speaker in a white button-down shirt standing in front of a very ethereal-looking, cloudy background shot through with this kind of heavenly light. So, I don't know, I'm kind of having second thoughts about whether she's in the TED Talk mode. Because when I was watching the film, I guess I picked up on two characters. So, what is the character that she's in during that clip?
So, during that clip, it's very subtle, but the kind of top buttons of her button-down shirt are unbuttoned.
Okay.
So, two of the characters is the TED Talk, like, she's on, you know?
Yeah.
Hi. Yeah. And then this clip at the beginning and some interspersed at the beginning, when she's a little bit more loosened up is like her, you know, the actor that is playing the TED talker. Hmm. So like, you know, these tale, like, let me tell you what this is really about. Like this is, you know, what sort of underlying that intro is like, this is a story about misogyny, you know, and she's saying it kind of cheekily. But then there are other moments where you see her and she's sort of like, you know, in the wings of the stage where she's sort of reflecting on, oh, I'm playing this character and I'm saying these words. What am I really saying? What am I really playing into? How am I, how is my unconscious impersonating misogynistic attitudes that I'm then kind of, you know, retransmitting outward. So there's like the character in character, the character becoming self-aware of their characterization. And then the third and final, which is really just way, way pushed back towards the end, is the transformation of her character, the removal of her body into that pure vocality where her voice is used at the end to mimic a kind of Alexa voice. So her personhood is sort of removed. Kind of what inspired this in a way is, so the voice of Siri, which was one of the first, that's like the Apple voice, was modeled after voice actor Susan Bennett. So they recorded this woman for hours and hours and hours and took all the phonemes or bits of her voice to reincorporate into whatever you want. Alexa is total, is like pure software. She's sort of like built from code. So anyway, so those are those three characterizations. And that whole intro, actually most of the text from that intro comes from an essay written by, and I apologize to you if you know this person or are this person, Karen Schlabach. And I was very excited to throw in to that also a quote from an Ani DiFranco song, who was very seminal to my upbringing as a tween.
Well, and same here, as I'm from Buffalo. And
oh, there you go.
Buffalonians have that love for Ani DiFranco.
Yeah, so that's the one Ani appearance, but I had to go in hard with that, hoping that if she ever sees this, you know. So in that intro, she's just to give you more context to how the narrative unfolds, she's describing a story of a bird, echo, and software. So we go through the first third is about this myth of a shepherdess turned into a bird, because she sort of challenged the boy shepherd. And then the story of Echo from Echo and Narcissus from Ovid's Metamorphoses. And then finally, this, what I'm calling a sort of more contemporary myth of Alexa, or rather how Alexa has her lineage in these former characters.
Yes, and there's a very clear kind of through line between this piece, Alexa Echoes, and between Scylla and Charybdis in this, the centrality of the female voice. I guess, I don't know, how do you see female utterance or oration or speech as different from male speech or utterance or oration?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, there is a sense of, like an innate, I think from, you know, being a young person, a sense of the sort of, limitations to, speech. I mean, mm-hmm. I've always have had a slightly deeper voice. And as a, even as a young person, and sort of, went through a very early age, androgynous phase, so much to the point where, you know, I would wear, you know, a girl's bathing suit, and with my short hair and other forms of demeanor were assumed to be male. Mm. And there was something that was very empowering about that. It was like, oh, I can say and do things that are different. So I think, you know, and was always sort of made fun of for my voice as a young person, because of maybe its pitch, but that felt very empowering again, because I could impersonate. Actually, now that you're saying it, I'm remembering I've gotten in a lot of trouble to the point of police, like in middle school for prank calling, because there was so much available. It felt like there was so much available to me, in that kind of impersonation. So there's definitely already an acknowledgement of power. Yeah. and the power or powerlessness, depending on what kind of voice I would be presenting. Mm-hmm. And also just a, you know, a very obvious sense of the self-regulation of myself or other women in my life from an early age, of what is being said. Mm-hmm. And how it's being said and how it can or cannot be said. So I think it's just part of just being an aware person, you know, inhabiting a cis female form. Mm-hmm. And I think also, like I said, there's something, I think in just reading, there's other aspects of the sort of, you know, reproductive body that has so much to do with porousness and spillage. Mm-hmm. and the boundarylessness of inside and outside. And that it always felt like the voice and was akin to that the female vocalizations in my household were always related to the body, to, mm-hmm. Hormones, mm-hmm. you know? So the body is leaking, the voice is leaking uncontrollably. And that's what women do. And that's how women are, or the withholding of the voice, and the sort of pain and internalization of pain with that withholding. So I think, you know, it has so much to do with power, with self-expression, with trauma, with how, and maybe connects back to that longing to self-express.
Mm-hmm.
I did this in when I was a young person, I did a kind of chart reading that was, I'm like a Pisces sun with a Taurus rising. And there's something in that combination that the voice is what you're known for, that combination of star and ascendant are like known for the voice. So there's, I think, and again, my mother's voice was always a thing because I knew there was something not right about her, but she would never let that on, honey. You know, it was always, something's amiss and I'm being this female voice, this mothering voice is manipulating me.
Hmm.
Which then also connects to just the sort of, cruelty, that comes with, you know, the idealizations of mother and motherhood. And you know, that sort of, all the ills of the world can be put on mothers,
yeah.
To blame and, to both save, but yet save us, mm-hmm. help us, save us. You know, it's a cruelty, and it also just sort of takes the focus, the blame away from the true inequities and injustices, which are really inherent in the violence of patriarchy and capitalism that women suffer through and endure, and then get put under the bus for, mm-hmm. as blamed for, which also goes to why I became interested in that, in the Between Silent Charybdis piece, or in the waterways at all, in becoming a mom. It's just, I became more attuned to that bodily leakage, you know, just the, mm-hmm. the fluids of childbirth, the fluids of breastfeeding. It's like the realizing another layer of my, you know, the aqueousness of my body being interconnected to that of the world, mm-hmm. and like, oh, what am I putting in my body that then is going to my breast milk to my child, you know? Or even if it's not breast milk, it's what are you mixing your, the powdered milk in with your tap water, and who's polluting that tap water, and who's responsible for that?
Yeah.
And so it just, you know, and certain things like, you know, our country hates poor people and hates women who over reproduce. And that becoming another layer of like, women are responsible for my environmental collapse because mm-hmm. they're making too many babies. I had a friend actually tell me before I got pregnant with my first, you know, how could you do that? You know, you're contributing to a carbon footprint, you know, as if I'm the problem. I'm the problem. It's very convoluted, but, I think it goes there.
We're animals.
I mean, yeah.
We reproduce if we want to.
Yes. I didn't create the industry that's actually doing the polluting.
Yeah.
You know, look at that. But in any event, I think that going back to this all connects back to the voice, because this is very personal. I mean, you're hearing my voice now. It's like, it comes from the mouth, and what's more intimate than other things that go in the mouth, like food.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's just, no one else can experience that but you. And the voice comes through also the it's not just the resonance, but it's also through the sort of, you know, when your mouth is dry, the voice doesn't really emanate.
Mm-hmm.
So it's also the kind of the liquid of the body that's helping mm-hmm. this sound come through, and why vocalists need a lot of warm water, because that kind of helps make it sound smooth. And so it's a lot of things.
Yeah. I mean, it's a really, I think, unique material to work with as an artist, because of thinking about the word leakage or spillage, because the voice is so literally visceral and so much affected by your state of health and energy and, like you said, lubrication. And yet it's the medium that we use for logos, in order to, you know, express ideas and concepts, which can be translated into text and And so there's this, it's definitely this interesting location in which the intellect and the body are, you know, one and the same, mm-hmm. Or emerging from the same place. And again, that play between the two is very much felt in your work. I want to bring up another image that repeats throughout the film, which is the wind farm. It made me think about the hydropower that's used in between Scylla and Charybdis, which is another sort of sublime or arresting object that's powered by the natural environment. In some sense, I just want to point out that connection. And I think we've touched on this a little bit. But what interests you about the idea of technology powered by elemental forces?
Yeah, thank you. I don't know how I didn't think about that correlation of that or the relationship of those two images together. So thank you. And I'll just say, because you mentioned that sort of sublime cloud image at the beginning, there's a Miriam was referring to a clip that does appear in Alexa Echoes of these clouds over a city sort of landscape, and a static shot of this wind farm in the middle of a desert. And then there's another shot of a city. And if you're not familiar with Seattle, it is downtown Seattle, but all of these are stock footage. The one of the kind of heavenly sky was found by searching Silicon Valley. And it was, that particular clip is clouds over Silicon Valley. And as we know, the multi-meaning now of the word cloud, mm-hmm. as a form of storage. And I just liked this idea of just finding, like the sourcing of the script, from other writers as sort of like stock information and sort of the idea of like the stock footage, the sort of type, or archetypes of spaces and places and people. And so, my interest in that is sort of, is thinking about, repeat the end of that question again.
Yeah. So what interests you about the idea of technology powered by elemental forces?
Right. So I think that in one way, the elemental forces are seen and unseen. So it kind of relates back to the sort of invisible forces at work, whether that's in our psyche, whether that's the back-end programming to the softwares that we're dependent on, mm-hmm. Whether that's just the alignment of the stars and planets at any one time that's actually having some sort of magnetic pull on us that's making us feel X, you know, collectively. So there's a pointing to acknowledgement of unseen forces as they are. Mm-hmm. And also of this idea of like, you know, well, using these elemental forces will save us, in this sort of like, I'm wearing a sweatshirt that says love your mother with the planet, this sort of like Gaia, you know, mm-hmm. like, Gaia will find a way, mm-hmm. you know, and this, again, this sort of, pressure of the Mother Earth to redeem us from all of our sins of extractive, pollutive forms of industry, mm-hmm. and never-ending, always available technology. And even just looking at that image of the wind farm in this idyllic, it looks beautiful,
yeah.
but it completely, like the way the, you know, Hunter Mountain has just been scarified to make these ski slopes. I mean, it's a violence, mm-hmm. upon the land and all the things and, you know, the people and places that came before it to then become, you know, a storage place for data that we really have no extended plan on how to maintain. And that will all go away. Mm. It's not archival, unless we perpetually find ways of extracting forms of energy to make it live on.
Has this line of inquiry been somehow motivated by the setting in which you live. You live in the Catskills. So were you asking these questions when you were living in New York City, or did this work somehow emerge out of the experience of living in the mountains?
Yeah, I think the latter. Just thinking of, okay, well, we process our own, we cut down our own trees, mm-hmm. we do a lot of firewood processing, we have a wood burning stove, we also have, mini split electric heat pumps, and talk about, we could switch to solar power and then we'll be like off the grid, and then, oh, but all the Congolese women, men, and children who are enslaved and dying from the cobalt mining that goes into the lithium ion batteries to supply the solar power. It's like there becomes there's no like consumer choice that is actually redemptive, and so it does create this kind of crisis of acknowledging those truths and the kind of connections and extent to violence that. Creates comforts mm-hmm. Elsewhere. And so having to make those decisions as a homeowner, and we have thought, we have a big hill, can we put a windmill up there?
Right.
So those are concerns that feel insurmountable.
Well, to close the show, I want to ask you about what you have coming up. Are there any upcoming projects or exhibitions that you want to mention?
So this piece that's at RIT, as I said, is up through 2025. And there are some talks with, the Eastman School of Music is out in Rochester. And I have some plans to sort of do an outdoor sort of symphonic performance that where instrumentalists perform alongside whatever is happening with the vocalizations at that time, potentially in the summer solstice of 2025. That's far in advance. And I say that because I will be having another baby in 2 months. So I have avoided planning anything for the next at least 6 to 9 months.
Understandable.
Yes, but definitely also Alexa Echoes was envisioned as a trilogy. And as I mentioned at the start, that sort of, dive into the sort of gendering and racialization of vocality, sort of the race of sound, which is the title of a book. And I'm blanking on the author, and I deeply apologize to you. I have a 3-year-old and am experiencing many hormones and heat at this moment in my body. But thank you. I hope she does too. Working on conceptualizations of those other iterations, but yeah.
And where can people learn more about your work?
So my website is pohanamandaturner.com. And the link to the live stream of the audio that you heard at the top of the sculpture Between Scylla and Charybdis is Between Scylla and Charybdis /pohanamandaturner.com. Hopefully, I'm saying these things very fast, assuming that they will be on the link to where you found this interview.
Yes. Yes, we will add those links.
Okay.
Well, Pohan, I really enjoyed this conversation. Thank you so much for sitting down with me today.
Thank you, Miriam. I appreciate it. Thank you, Wave Farm.
Thank you, Wave Farm. Thank you.
Story hour. Radio plays.